This is Dr. David Mathewson in his teaching on New Testament Greek 3. This is session number 3, Cases and Pronouns.
In this lecture, we want to finish up the case system in Greek and then move on to pronouns. And one thing you'll find out is everything you learn about case in the first lecture and part of this one applies to pronouns as well. And so we kind of treat them together. But we want to look at the two final cases. And one of them, the vocative case, again, there's some debate as to whether it is a separate case or whether it belongs with a nominative. I'm not going to attempt to settle that, but just look at the function of it. But the other case, major case, that we want to consider is the accusative case. And you learned one of the major functions, and probably the most common function of the accusative case in first year Greek, and that is a noun in the accusative case commonly functions as the direct object of a verb in a sentence, or the recipient of the action in a sentence or in a clause. And for example, in Mark chapter 1 and verse 3, prepare the way. I think it is ton hadon. Tain hadon. Prepare the way. Tain hadon is in the accusative case. It functions as the direct object of the imperative. And again, there's slews of examples of that in the New Testament, where the accusative is probably the most common case that functions as, or indicates that a noun is functioning as a direct object. Now, there's a couple of other functions of the accusative case that I think are sort of subsets of this. One of them is what is often called the cognate accusative, and that's basically just a direct object accusative. But what that is the noun in the accusative case, the direct object, is cognate to or comes from the same stem as the verb itself. We do this in English sometimes. We might say to pray a prayer. Pray is your verb and prayer is your direct object. They're both cognate. They come kind of from the same word. And you find that several times in the New Testament. Again, to use an example of in 1 Timothy 6:12, I'll talk a little bit more about the textbook that I'm looking at, but in 1 Timothy 6:12, to fight the good fight, agoidzu is your verb to fight, an imperative, fight, and then agona, fight the fight. So fight the fight. So those are both cognate. And you know, there's various explanations for why that's the case. Sometimes it may lend more emphasis to speak like that, but basically, it's not really a separate function of the accusative. It's more of a subset of the direct object use. It just is that the direct object happens to be cognate to the verb that it serves as the direct object for. So let me say something about this before we go on. This is a textbook that I'm kind of following in this lecture because I'm one of the co-authors, and one of my colleagues, Elodie Emig, and myself wrote a second-year grammar that is meant for courses like this. And it is full of illustrations. So due to time, some of the illustrations I use will be minimal. But if you want other examples, plenty of examples of the different grammatical categories that we're discussing, I would highly recommend purchasing this book. And even, as you work through this course, using and reading each chapter. The lectures will basically follow the order of the chapters in this textbook, and so you can read this along with it. Another function of the accusative case is what is known as the double accusative. Now, what this means is some verbs tend to, they don't have to, but they tend to take two direct objects to complete them, two nouns in the accusative case to complete them. Now, that's different from saying, you know, that a verb has two direct objects. Any verb can have two, three, four direct objects. I could say in English, I went to the store and I bought bread and milk and juice and fruit. And I can just have as many direct objects as I want. This is different. There are some verbs that they don't necessarily have to, but they tend to take two accusatives to complete them. For example, to give an example in English, I might say, and there's, I know there's different ways to think about this sentence, but I might say, I teach you Greek. And I know there's probably different ways to look at this in English, but one, if this were a Greek sentence, the you and Greek would both be direct objects in the accusative case. And the verb teach, in fact, the verb teach in Greek is one of those verbs that can take two direct objects to complete it. And in this case, notice the word you indicates the person that I'm teaching, and Greek would indicate the subject or the thing that I'm teaching. And some grammars would say this is an accusative, double accusative of person and thing. So I just want you to be alert to that some verbs in Greek tend to, or they can, they don't have to, but they can take two direct objects. And again, if you look at further at this grammar or the grammar by Dan Wallace, and it gives you a list of the kinds of verbs that tend to take two direct objects to complete them. A good example is found in Revelation chapter 3 and verse 12 of a double accusative construction. And Revelation chapter 3 and verse 12 is a promise to the one who overcomes. And Jesus promises to the one who overcomes, I will make poieso. Poieo, to do or to make, is one of those verbs that you do sometimes find taking two direct objects or two accusatives, a double accusative. I will make him, Altan, or her, a pillar, stulon. So notice you have two direct objects, two nouns in the accusative. One is of the person and one is the thing. I will make him, or her what? I will make him or her a pillar. And again, poieo, from which is the form that lies behind poieso, that's the future form, is one of those verbs that can take two accusatives. So just be aware of this construction. It's a rather specialized construction. Again, in my opinion, it's a kind of a subset of the direct object. But again, it's restricted to certain verbs. Don't confuse it with the fact that any verb can take two, three, four, as many direct objects as you want. But this refers to certain verbs like didasko, I teach, or poieo, I do or I make, and a handful of other verbs that don't have to, but they can take two accusatives to complete them. And this is a good example from Revelation chapter 3 and verse 12. And then the last category that I want to draw your attention to, the last function of the accusative case. Kind of has a number of subsets in it, but it is what is known as the adverbial accusative. In this case, the accusative case, or the noun in the accusative, functions like an adverb. It will modify the verb, and there's a number of ways it can act. Sometimes it can show manner. It can also show time, an adverbial accusative of time. So we've seen the genitive case, the dative case, and now the accusative case can indicate time. And again, there's all kinds of debate. Some would say it refers to extent of time. That does work in some cases, but at other cases, I have to admit, I'm at a loss to figure out why the author chose an accusative instead of a dative or a genitive. This is easy to identify because the noun will be a time word. Once more, month or year or hour or Sabbath or some unit measurement of time in the accusative case. So adverbial accusative. A good example of time is found in in the Gospel of John, chapter 1, verse 39. It says, referring to the disciples, "So they went and saw where he was staying and stayed with him that day." And the word in John is hemeron, the noun for day. And clearly, again, that's John 1:39. Clearly, this is not the direct object of the sentence. And notice, it's a measurement of time, day. And here in the accusative case, it's indicating the time at which the action of the verb takes place. The key is that the noun in the accusative case will function like an adverb. So those are all the usages of the accusative that I want to draw your attention to. And I would say, too, that the accusative case is probably the least significant case exegetically. The cases probably should be seen in relationship to each other, with the genitive and the dative probably indicating the most significant usages and the most prominent cases. And then after that, I'd rank the nominative and vocative, and then the accusative would probably be last. And it's probably the case that you will draw the least amount of significance exegetically and when it comes to importance in the text. The last case function that I want to draw your attention to, and I'll just mention it briefly because it basically only has one function, and that is the vocative case. And as I said, there's some debate as to whether this is a separate case form. If it is, Greek has five cases. If it's a subset of or belongs to the nominative case, Greek is a four-case system. I'm not going to worry about that right now, but simply talk a little bit about the vocative. It basically has one function, and that is, direct address, where the author will use the vocative case to directly address or engage his readers. You see this form used commonly in 1 John and in James. Forms such as adelphoi, brothers, or children in 1 John. And often what it does is the vocative case can function to introduce prominent material because it directly engages and addresses the readers. In 1 John and probably in James as well, it's often used as a structural marker to indicate units throughout the book. So just be aware of this usage, and it doesn't have multiple functions like the other cases do, and that may be one of the reasons why some think it's just a subset of, or one of the, it's part of the nominative case system. If you remember your forms, only in the singular does it have a different form than, you know, for example, adelphoi, this is your plural, that's the identical ending to the nominative case. But again, I don't want you to worry a whole lot. Is this a fourth, fifth case, or is it the nominative? As much as focusing on the function of it to address the readers, to often indicate prominence, and then as a structural marker as well. So that is the case system in Greek, and as I said, the case system is also significant for understanding the next grammatical category that we want to discuss, and that is pronouns. Everything we've learned about case is applicable to pronouns. Let me just make a couple of comments about pronouns. I'm not going to spend a lot of time unpacking each of the pronouns. I simply want to list them and just explain a little bit about what they are. But I want to make a number of comments that are applicable to all the pronouns when it comes to interpretation. And the first one, the first thing I want to say when it comes to pronouns is the point that I just mentioned, and that is everything we've learned about case function applies to pronouns. So pronouns, we'll talk more about what they are, but pronouns take case, and they function as subjective genitives or descriptive genitives. They function as subject nominatives. They can function as a predicate nominative, as an accusative direct object, as a dative of reference, or dative in anything that a noun can do, a pronoun can do. As you figured out, the name pronoun suggests that they function as a noun does. So when it comes to pronouns, one of the things that you need to do in analyzing a pronoun is not just ask, what kind of pronoun is this? We'll see there's various kinds. But also ask, what is the case function of the pronoun? Whether it's in the nominative, genitive, or whatever. The second thing that you need to pay attention to is, what is the antecedent of the pronoun? One of the kind of misconceptions, it's not wrong, it's just too limited, that you often hear pronouns defined as, a pronoun is a word that takes the place of another noun. That is only partially correct. You'll see, and the same is true in English too, but you'll see especially in Greek, that sometimes pronouns do take the place of other nouns. But at other times, a pronoun can take the place of or refer to, and when we use the language of it takes the place of or refers to, we're referring to the antecedent. What does the pronoun refer to in the context? Sometimes it is a word. At other times, you will find that the pronoun stands for a grammatical unit much larger than a word. So, for example, we might say, Jesus chose the disciple and said to him, auto, for example. That pronoun auto, from autos, refers to and stands for one word, disciple. Jesus chose a disciple, or Jesus addressed the disciple and said to him. I kind of made that up. But him refers back to one word, disciple. However, a good example in Greek of the use of the pronoun that refers to more than just one word is found in Romans chapter 5. And I'm sorry. Romans chapter 5 and verse 12. In Romans chapter 5 and verse 12, the author begins his comparison between Adam and Christ. And it begins, verse 12 begins, dia tuta, because of this. Tuta is your pronoun. It's a demonstrative pronoun. But what is the this that Paul's referring to? Well, there's actually quite a bit of debate. One time I read a number of commentaries, and I found some of them saying, well, it refers back to the last two verses right before it, verses 10 and 11 of chapter 5, verses 1 through 11 is kind of a beginning of a new unit or a transition in Paul's thought because of this, because of what Paul just said in 10 through 11. Or verses 10 and 11 of chapter 5. Some other commentary said, no, it actually goes back to chapter 5, 1 through 11. And the whole, those 11 verses in the first part of chapter 5, that whole section. Others said, no, it goes back to chapter 3 and verse 21, where Paul begins his argument about justification by faith. In the first two chapters and into chapter 3, he's established the sinfulness of all humanity, Jew and Gentile alike. And in verse 21, now he kind of begins his argument that there's a justification, a righteousness of God available that comes through faith. Some have suggested that the dia tuta goes back to that. Let me write the dia tuta. And this is the pronoun, tuta. Some have suggested it goes all the way back to chapter 3 and verse 21. And others have said, no, it goes all the way back to chapter 1, the whole first part of the book, because of this, the whole argument. My point is not here not to settle that, but just to show you that pronouns don't necessarily refer to just one noun. That, yeah, they do sometimes. But at other times, the pronoun can refer to a much larger unit of thought or much larger grammatical unit. So I would define a pronoun as a word that stands in for a grammatical unit of various sizes, whether from a word to a sentence to sometimes an entire paragraph or larger unit of discourse. And so tutab is a good example of that. So that one of the things that you need to do is make sure you understand when you see a pronoun of any kind, make sure you understand what the antecedent is. Is it a single person or word, or is it a larger unit of discourse? And sometimes pronouns can refer to, often they'll have their antecedent within the text, but sometimes they'll refer to something outside of the text, appealing to the reader's knowledge of something outside of the text. So sometimes the antecedent is really easy. At other times, it can be a little bit tricky to determine exactly what it is. And then, obviously, another important step in interpretation is to understand what kind of pronoun is it. So those three things, not necessarily in that order. You might want to start with number three, actually, first. What kind of pronoun am I dealing with? And then move on to what's its case function? And then wrestling with what's the antecedent, which, again, sometimes is really easy and may not be overly significant. At other times, like dia tuta in Romans 5:12, it may be more tricky to figure it out and could be more significant and more important. For number three, what are the various kinds of pronouns? Just to reiterate what we have said in the text, in our textbook, the first type of pronoun is what is known as, and this is probably one of the most common types, is the personal pronoun, like ego, I, hey mice, we, Sue, you, who mice, you plural, autos is a really heavily worked pronoun in the New Testament, meaning he or she or it, depending on the gender of it as well. So personal pronouns is one one usage of the pronoun. Another one is the intensive pronoun, which is the use of the pronoun autos. So autos actually does double and triple duty in the New Testament. It can be just a personal pronoun, he, she, or it, but then it can be intensive as well. And you'll translate it, something like the word same, the same one. You'll find it, in this case, it's an adjective modifying another noun. The same Lord, it'll be in the same case, gender, number as the noun it modifies. And the same Lord, the same disciple, the same boat, the same city, whatever. You'll find the same Spirit, you'll find autos in the same case, gender, number as a noun that it's modifying, and it's functioning intensively. Another type of pronoun is the possessive pronoun. Possessive pronouns like emas and sas, hemeteros, humeteros, our, your. Those are pronouns that by their meaning express possession. One of the more common ways of showing possession is a personal pronoun in the genitive case. The genitive showing possession. But Greek also has a number of possessive pronouns that by their very meaning show belonging or possession. A very important one and common one is the demonstrative pronoun. And that would be usually in Greek, as with English too, I guess, but in Greek, there's a distinction between near demonstratives and far demonstratives. That is, near demonstratives point to something near, either physically or at least in the mind of the author, and usually the English translation, this or these, the word houtos, this. That was the word used in Romans 5:12, dia tuta, because of this. That tuta is from the demonstrative houtos, this. Or far, akenos, when something is remote in physical space or even at least in the author's mind. Akenos can be used, that or those for the plural. So demonstrative pronouns are very common in the Greek New Testament and indicating spatially or even mentally nearness or farness in the discourse. Another important pronoun, I'll kind of start back up at the top so I don't run off the bottom of the board, is the interrogative pronoun. Interrogative, which asks a question. And there's basically three kind of forms of the interrogative. Tis is one of the more common ones. Poios, and then pasos. These are the most common interrogative pronouns, and they serve to, as the term implies, interrogative, they serve to introduce a question. Another important pronoun is the reflexive. Reflexive pronoun, such as amaltu, myself, or saaltu. And the purpose of the reflexive pronoun is that it reflects the action of the verb back upon the subject. So, I might say in English, I dress myself. So I perform an action back upon myself, reflect an action, a verbal process back on the subject. And so myself or yourself are important reflexive type of pronouns that you find in the New Testament. Just a couple of others to draw your attention to. One of them is the reciprocal pronoun. Reciprocal pronoun, allelon. Hopefully some of these you remember from first year Greek. But the reciprocal pronoun basically will express a mutual relationship. An action is done, for example, within a mutual relationship between the subject. So usually we translate it one another. They spoke to one another. They spoke to each other, or something like that. It indicates an interchange of action among a group of people. So the reciprocal pronoun. Another very important pronoun is the relative pronoun. And the relative pronoun, basically, this is kind of different than some of the other pronouns because it introduces its own clause. So to use an English example, I could say, I spoke to the student who was in the library. Now notice, here's your relative pronoun in English, who. And notice that it introduces its own clause, who was in the library. Here it's the subject, who, and the verb was, is was, and then in the library, indicating the location of the student. But notice that this relative clause functions like an adjective to modify student. And that's the same that's a common usage in Greek. I spoke to the student, and student is further defined or described as being in the library. And the key with relative pronouns is basically, and I said basically because there are exceptions to this, but basically, the relative pronoun will agree with its antecedent in gender and number. Now, why didn't I include case? Why just gender and number? Why not case? Because the case of the pronoun is determined by how it acts within its own clause. Here it's the subject, so it would be in the nominative case. If the relative pronoun is a direct, we're not talking about the whole sentence, just the clause. The relative pronoun, and by the way, the relative pronoun will come at the beginning. There's again a couple of exceptions to that, but generally the relative pronoun will come at the beginning of its clause. So you see a relative pronoun, you should be looking for the words that come after that help make up the relative clause. But the relative pronoun, and that's why I put it in parentheses in this illustration, the relative pronoun's case will be determined by how it acts within its own clause. If it's the subject, it will be nominative. If it's the direct object, it will be in the accusative. It's an indirect object, or the dative case. If it's possession, the genitive case, or something like that. The gender and number will always be determined by the noun that it modifies. But the purpose of the, or one of the main functions of a relative clause and a relative pronoun is an adjective. It will modify another noun. And that's what it's doing here in this English example. I spoke to the student who was in the library. Here the relative clause functions as an adjective to modify student. Now, to give you another example as far as how the relative clause can function, what if I did this in English? I will give an A to So I'm feeling really generous. I will give an A to whoever completes the assignment. Now notice, I'm going to include this. Here's your relative clause, and here's your relative pronoun in English. What is this doing now? Notice it's not modifying anything in this sentence, like an adjective. It's not modifying I. It's not modifying A. This is the letter grade. Instead, it's functioning as the indirect object. It's functioning like a noun. And relative clauses can do that. So the first example I showed a minute ago, the relative clause modifies a noun. I talked to the student who was in the library. But now the relative clause is not modifying a noun, it's acting like a noun. In this case, it's the indirect object telling to whom I will give the A, to whoever completes the assignment. So here's the whole relative clause. It has its own verb, it has its own direct object, but the whole clause functions like a noun. It functions as the indirect object of the sentence. And it can do that in Greek as well as in English. For example, just to give you an example from Greek, so I'm not only giving English examples. This one is out of our textbook, and it comes out of Hebrews 8 through 9, at chapter 8 and verse 9, and it's not according to the covenant. Diatheken, not according to the covenant which I made with their fathers. I won't write the rest of it, but the article introduces a clause with their fathers. So notice here, this is your relative pronoun, hain, and the relative pronouns are rather easy to spot, or because they'll have two characteristics. They'll have a rough breather and they'll have an accent, both of those at the same time. A rough breather and an accent, and this one has a rough breather and an accent on the vowel that comes at the beginning of the word. So here's your relative pronoun, hain, and notice that it introduces its own clause, which I made with their fathers. That's your relative clause. Now notice here, it's modifying. It's functioning as an adjective to modify a noun. It's modifying the noun diatheken. So notice it's in the same gender and number as diatheken. It's singular and it's feminine because diatheken is feminine. It's accusative because it's functioning as the direct object of the verb. The subject is I. I made which? With your fathers. So it's diatheken happens to be accusative too, but that's not why this is accusative. This is an accusative. Hain is your accusative relative pronoun. It's accusative because it's functioning as the direct object of the verb in the relative clause. We're not talking about the whole sentence. We're just talking about the relative clause. So that is one of the keys, or probably one of the main keys, to discussing and to considering relative clauses is, again, recognizing what is the antecedent of the pronoun, and then how is the relative clause functioning? Is it modifying another noun, acting like an adjective, or does it act like a noun itself? In this case, it's functioning like an adjective to modify the noun diathekein. So that is all that we're going to say about pronouns. Again, to recap, the three most important things to think about when you deal with pronouns is, number one, what kind of pronoun? Dealing with these eight, there may be a couple of other subsets, eight or nine types of pronouns. What kind of pronoun are you dealing with? What does it mean? Is it relative? Is it a reflexive pronoun? Is it a reciprocal pronoun, a personal pronoun? What is the meaning of it? The second thing you want to consider is, what is the antecedent of the pronoun? Does it refer to a single word? Does it refer to a sentence, a larger paragraph, a larger unit of discourse? What is the antecedent? Don't assume that you know. And then third, what's the case function? Because pronouns will have case. And everything you learned about cases is applicable to pronouns as well.
This is Dr. David Mathewson in his teaching on New Testament Greek 3. This is session number 3, Cases and Pronouns.